is still the is the case in that struggle. I don't think that an utterly destabilized, well, Syria is destabilized. If it completely falls apart, I think that's bad news, not just for Israel but for a lot of countries in the region. I don't. That's where I would fault American policy, on its own head, not just based on our relationship to the client state. I mean, why? What we're going to achieve by just bombing these people to smithereens with so many civilian casualties? It will just fuel extremism.
Sure, and you can't. There's no borders. They're not a state. They are an idea, not a state. Anyway,
right.
That said,
and the West helped create that idea.
We did, indeed. Yes. Thank you so much, Philip. My guest, of course, is Pete Philip Weiss. He is the founder and co-editor of MondoWeiss.net, and I do commend listeners' attention to the article on Trump and the Middle East. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, December 14th, 2015. Kate Welsh engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Ornette, Made in America, showing Thursday, December 17th at 7 p.m. Released in 1985, Ornette, Made in America, explores the rhythms, images, and myths of America seen through the eyes of an Ornette Coleman's imagination and artistic evolution over three decades. Again, that's Ornette, Made in America, Thursday, December 17th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Music, Nature, and Storytelling, an experiential weekend workshop from January 8th through the 10th at Cedar Ridge Retreat and Conference Center in Vernonia, Oregon. Storytelling as a practice broadens our perspective and helps us understand the significance of our experiences. This workshop teaches the roots of storytelling and delves into the storyteller's mind. No prior experience required, and the deadline for registration is December 18th. Again, that's Music, Nature, and Storytelling, a weekend workshop January 8th through the 10th at Cedar Ridge Retreat in Vernonia, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. On our overheated and overcrowded planet, civilizations' fingerprints are everywhere, from plastic trash on the shores of the Arctic Ocean to the effects of global climate change on the most remote landscapes. This morning, we're going to examine the question, how do wild places maintain their value in this age of humans? My guest is journalist and urban farmer Jason Mark, who in his new book, Satellites in the High Country, travels beyond the bright lights and certainties of our cities to seek wildness wherever it survives. Jason's writings on the environment have appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic.com, the Nation, Salon.com. He is a longtime editor of Earth Island Journal, a quarterly magazine, and co-founder of San Francisco's largest urban farm. Jason, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. I really appreciate it.
It's great to have you on. You have a great line in your book. You quote Thoreau's famous line, "In wildness is the preservation of the world," and then you turn it a little bit and you say, "In wildness is the perpetuation of the world." So I wanted to know what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think I kind of wrote this book because, as you point out, with that Thoreau line, wildness has long been the touchstone for the modern environmental movement, right? It's kind of been the heartbeat of a worldview. And the question is, and the question I explore in Satellites in the High Country, is whether there's anything that's still really, truly wild today in the 21st century. And, I went to some of the most rugged and remote places in America to explore that question. And that line, actually, "In wildness is the perpetuation of the world," came to me when I was rafting through the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Because if you think about and you understand that wildness doesn't mean untouched by civilization, it just means undominated, then I think wildness becomes more important than ever, and partially sort of as a petri dish for evolution, right? The continually unspooling of life. And if you understand that connection between evolution, then yes, you see that actually wild places are where actually life itself is able to perpetuate itself, regardless of our designs and our intentions.
Well, one of your goals in this book was actually to find these wild places and to see how much wildness was still there. And interestingly, there's three examples that popped out in my mind of experiences you have where you went, for instance, to the Ho River rainforest in the Olympic Peninsula, which is one of the few places, if not the only place in the lower 48 where you can't hear airplanes. And you did this amazing hike, peaceful, quiet, just filled with nature sounds hike until you're hiking out. At the very end, you hear a helicopter fly over your head. And you describe the jarring effect of that. Another case, when you come out of rafting through the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and you've hit the Arctic Ocean and you look down the beach and you see a plastic cooler lying on the beach. Again, another strange juxtaposition. But the one that really got me was your experience hiking through the Grand Canyon of Tuolumne River, and at the very end, you spot this incredible blue, brilliant lake along the trail. And your friend, who you're hiking with, who is not as seasoned a wilderness person as you, cries out, "This is the most beautiful wild nature he's ever seen." And no, it's not. It's actually the reservoir behind the Hetch Hetchy Dam. And that one is what I really think is. The other two are kind of accidental things, but that dam that blocks the Tuolumne River and dams up what a lot of people call the other Yosemite Valley is much more permanent and a much more conscious act. And I wonder how you see that as kind of violating some kind of sacrament of wilderness.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you, Barbara, for that close reading of the book. I really appreciate it. That was perhaps the original, right, modern environmental battle was John Muir's then nascent Sierra Club. And I should say, just by way of clarification, I no longer edit Earth Island Journal. I'm now the editor of Sierra Magazine, which is the national magazine of the Sierra Club. But even before I was working for the Sierra Club, I understood very closely the importance, historical importance, of that battle in protecting Hetch Hetchy Valley, which, of course, the Sierra Club lost and the power brokers in San Francisco and Sacramento won. And again, as you said, flooded what many people considered sort of the other Yosemite Valley. And why that kind of is a desecration, I guess you'd call it, is because it takes something that's wild, that again is untamed, that is living according to its own will. I mean, that's really what wildness means. It means self-willed. It means sovereign of itself. So the Tuolumne River, for much of its passage, is wild, right? It's not dominated by humans until it hits O'Shaughnessy Dam there at the base of Hetch Hetchy Valley and becomes essentially a giant bathtub, right? Becomes a reservoir for the city and county of San Francisco and other parts of Northern California. And so when that happens, the river is no longer wild. And it's so interesting. If you look at actually the legal wilderness boundary of Yosemite Wilderness, it stops at the edge of the reservoir, right? Because the river's been impounded. It's been essentially, I guess you could say, chained, right? And that's so important to recognize because it shows all the difference between accidents and intention. And I think the difference between accident and intention represents our best chance of finding a way to live with grace on this planet, right? So, yeah, the blue plastic cooler washed up on the shores of the Arctic Ocean, it's unfortunate, it's jarring, but it's essentially an accident, whereas building a giant dam is an intention. And what I'm arguing in the book is we need to exercise more intention than ever before in keeping some places wild and free.
When you describe that reservoir behind Chauncey Dam and how beautiful your friend found it, and it reminds me of a concern that I had actually as I discovered myself through living in the Northwest for a number of years. When I came out here from the East, I basically took all the dams and impounded water on the Columbia River for granted. It seemed like it was all part of the landscape. And actually, the first place I ever went backpacking was to Hetch Hetchy. And I remember walking along the rim of the reservoir, and I didn't even think, I mean, I saw the dam and I saw this waterfall at the other end, and it didn't even occur to me that there was something unnatural about it. And I think that a lot of people, maybe a majority of people who are not really wilderness types, don't understand when they look at landscapes that's really been humanized that they're not looking at nature. They're looking at something that has been really drastically changed and sometimes to the detriment of nature. And I wonder how we help people to see what nature once was and to understand that a lot of the artifices in nature are actually, in a lot of ways, don't belong there.
I mean, the short answer is that it's really, you ask, you know, how do we get people to sort of see almost as a kind of, I guess, historical x-ray vision, what the land might have once looked like. It's very hard. And it's very hard because of a phenomenon, which I discuss in that very scene there above Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. It's hard because of this phenomenon known as the shifting baseline. So this is a term that comes out of the field of conservation biology, and it basically refers to the fact that every generation bases its idea of a pristine nature or of a healthy, intact ecosystem on the memories of its childhood. And the then following generation will, of course, base its own ideas of a pristine or healthy ecosystem on its childhood, even if there's been a great degree of degradation, right, in the 25 years since. So what I, as a Generation Xer, might view a landscape as healthy, a baby boomer or, say, someone who's older than that might look at that same landscape and say, wow, that's not how I remember it at all. In a way, when it comes to trying to fix in our mind what a healthy, intact nature looks like, we're kind of running on a hamster wheel of collective amnesia. And the question is to answer your question, I guess the only way to kind of break that collective amnesia is essentially through a better understanding of natural history and environmental history. But that, you know, that takes a little bit of work, and that takes, I guess, on the part of conservation organizations or other advocacy groups. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of public education work to say, you might think this cell tower on this ridgeline is quote-unquote normal, but in fact, that's not how it's always been.
Well, I had a kind of funny step back in that way because I grew up on the East Coast where things were much further from nature than anything was in the Pacific Northwest when I came out here in the early 70s. And it's true that the dams were here and there were a lot of things that were here. There were mines in eastern Oregon, and I sort of took all that for granted. But also I was seeing nature that I had never seen, like old growth forests, which I couldn't even imagine before I came out to the West Coast. And then over the next 30 or so years, I watched this landscape get degraded even more. And I saw, you know, immense clear cuts coming in. And we went from, I think there was about 15% original old growth when I moved here to now there's less than 5%. So there's another thing that happens where as things start to shift in our own lifetime, it's in a way can inform us about what might have happened before. And what if you see a way to connect with people younger than you and younger than me who have them to start observing what's happening, it's changing, that might be disturbing them, and then to have them be able to connect back to the things that disturbances that bothered you growing up and the ones that bothered me, you know, 10 or 15 years before there, 20 years before that?
I mean, I think the key word that you just used there, Barbara, is observation, right? I mean, I think so much of creating a truly intimate, you know, personal relationship with wild nature involves actually just watching, witnessing, and paying attention. I want to make clear that that doesn't need to happen in the deep, remote wilderness. I mean, that can happen at your backyard bird feeder, right? Watching the comings and goings of birds through the season. It can come in your backyard vegetable patch, you know, watching how the weather changes and is going to continue to change more radically with global climate changes. That small act of observation, that's really important. And I think really the only way to make that happen is to really, you know, encourage people to get out, and it's about boots on the ground. I mean, I think I've done a pretty good job in Satellites in the High Country of discussing the importance of wilderness, but there's no substitute for actually, and a book can do a lot, you know, but there's no substitute for actually getting out there on landscape. And if we're going to encourage, I guess what you could call ecological mindfulness, there's no substitute for getting people of all ages out in the woods, to the seashore, to the desert, et cetera, to actually start engaging in that act of observation.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Jason Mark, who's just written a new book called Satellites in the High Country about the importance of preserving and perpetuating wild places around the world and the challenges that we face. Well, I find it interesting to compare the experience that you have in a city when you find some precious wild spaces in the city. I just was thinking about this a lot yesterday. I live just about a block from a wildlife refuge and wetland in southeast Portland, right on the Willamette River. And I go down there every day. And yesterday I was down there and I was face to face with a common egret. And I'm really about 4 feet away and spent a long time just watching this bird eating in the most marvelous ways that they have to eat, and wondering why it was so close to where people walk on the trail, and just kind of getting a whole understanding of that. And I was thinking about in your book how you talk about when you go into wilderness, it's a whole different experience than being in nature in the city. And I wonder if you can talk about the differences and why you think it's important for people to experience wilderness as well as city nature, but also ways that maybe connecting to natural areas close by, nearby nature, I think is what you call it, that can maybe prepare you to take the next step and go into the wilderness.
Yeah, thank you again, Barbara, for that really thoughtful question. I think the big challenge, you know, the 21st century conservation movement in some ways is to kind of walk and chew gum, right, is to encourage both a love and a respect for the nearby nature, which again is the, you know, the local regional park or wetland or seashore, because these are the places where we're most likely to create our most intimate, consistent relationship with wild nature. And there's a lot of wildness that is sneaking and has snuck back into the cities. I mean, there are mountain lions living within the city of Los Angeles. You can think about the comeback of the wolf, to the Mountain West, even the raccoons that live in the cities. There's a lot of wildness that lives in or on the edges of urban areas, and that's so important for, I think, kind of serving as a gateway drug.
At the same time,
there's no substitute for those big, open, remote wilderness areas, because that's where wildness, you know, is able to express itself most fully. And I think it's really there where a modern urban city dweller, and I'm among those too. I live in Oakland, California, right? I don't, you know, live off in the Sierras as much as some days I might like to. I think for us urban modern dwellers, getting out of the big remote wildernesses, it can really be a hugely cathartic experience, right? To find yourself in a place where you're essentially outnumbered by other critters. To be in a landscape that's not humanized, like the way our suburbs and farms are. And to recognize that in a wild land, most of the action passes unseen. You know, we're not even able to notice much of what's happening. And that's a profound experience. And I think what it does is it creates a new and deeper reverence for non-human life. And I quote in the book the eminent environmental historian, Rod Nash, who says that essentially the wilderness is kind of like a moral training ground for us. It's a real classroom, and I think I'm worried that we're at risk of losing the appreciation of that classroom, and that's why I wrote Satellites in the High Country.
Well, actually, that's one of the concerns that you raise in the book about, and I wasn't sure where you got the statistics, but it sounds like people under 40 don't go backpacking anymore. And though I would beg to differ about that, because I do run it when I go hiking around here in all around Mount Hood and Mount Adams, I see a number of people that I think are under 40 who are backpacking. So I'm hoping that there's still young people who backpack. But there is definitely a shift in the comfort zone, I think, that people have with being in wild places. And it, for me, it was kind of represented by that movie Blair Witch Project that came out a few years ago, which I thought was really show, like, and this is probably was your generation, actually, I think, that made that movie, but that there was this fear of nature that that's what I thought that movie was really about. These are people who, young people who didn't really know what to do when they were in the woods, and that film was shot in like a suburban woodlot, suburban Maryland. It wasn't exactly like a place you could get lost in very easily, unless you're really disoriented. So I wonder if you think it's really true that people are not as connected to wild places as they once were, and that it's not like the avocation of going backpacking isn't as popular with young people as it was when I was in my youth, or it is with you.
Well, first of all, so you know, some of the statistics I cite come from the Outdoor Recreation Association, and they've got pretty thorough, you know, numbers on who's engaging in outdoor recreation and what kind. And again, they define that pretty broadly. I mean, that includes urban jogging as well as backcountry backpacking. The quote, though, about nobody under 40 going backpacking is actually a quote from an environmental journalist named Christopher Ketchum, who's based partially out of Moab, Utah. I do think it's true. There's a grain of truth in it that the cohort of wilderness advocates are, in general, aging and graying and disproportionately white compared to the rest of the country. And so, and the conservation movement understands this quite clearly. I think people in the conservation movement, whether it's, again, the Sierra Club or Wilderness Society or any of the other kind of large or regional local conservation groups, recognize that we need to do a much better job in assuring that the wilderness constituency of the 21st century looks like this country, and that's going to mean younger, and it's going to mean more ethnically diverse, and it's a real challenge. At the same time, I have to say I'm hugely encouraged by what I see as the efforts to change that or address that. So, for example, I went to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge with a woman named Rue Mapp, who's got a group called Outdoor Afro. And Outdoor Afro does what it sounds like. It, Rue and her organization work to increase African-American participation in outdoor recreation. There's a similar group called Latino Outdoors. I'm really happy to say that the National Park Service, I interviewed the head of the National Park Service, John Jarvis, for the book. The National Park Service is doing really all it can to get urban youth into wild nature. And then you see the efforts of, again, the conservation community. You know, our last big national monument that was established, or one of them, I guess, in 2014, is right there on the edge of Los Angeles, right? 300,000 acres, those mountains that are right behind Los Angeles, because the largest single group of users to that area are Latinos in Los Angeles. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of efforts to address this issue, and I would say I'm cautiously optimistic that we will be successful in ensuring that there's a real deep and emotional connection of all Americans, regardless of age or ethnicity, to wild places.
Well, you talk about an interesting factor in your book about the ecology of fear, or the whole experience like that, or maybe the landscape of fear, that there's something about when you go into wild places where you have to really face your fears. And the fears can range from your own physical limitations to wild animals. And I want to talk about why you think that's so important, that and what kind of changes does that help somebody go through when they are out in the wilderness and do face their fears that way?
Yeah, that kind of gets back to your earlier question about sort of the virtues of the nearby nature, which I think most of all is sort of intimacy, right, the places we can go to most frequently, versus the virtues of the big remote wilderness that takes more time, effort, and money to get to. In the nearby nature, you're not likely to, I think, experience that sense of fear, right? You know you're going to be able to get back to your car pretty easily, and for the most part, in, say, the front country, like in the, right, you know, the Yosemite Valley or in the local regional preserve, you're unlikely to encounter large predators. And the big thing that distinguishes big wilderness is the presence of bears and wolves and mountain lions, things that rate up there with us as apex predators. Now, I want to make clear, you know, the incidences of lethal animal attacks on people are pretty rare. And yet, at the same time, you want to be careful and you want to be conscious. And I think that little extra edge and I've had this experience when you're in a wilderness with predators, it makes us realize that we're not as powerful as we might like to imagine, right? That all of our power, right, essentially comes from our technologies. And when you go into the wilderness, it's essentially making a voluntary decision to strip ourselves of our greatest powers, right? And I think that is hugely important, again, as a sort of moral training ground, to remember that, wow, we're not as powerful as we might think we are, and that, therefore, we owe responsibilities. We have mutual accountability to the other life here on the planet. And so I think, you know, the presence of predators on the landscape is good for us just as a kind of reality check about where we fall in the greater scheme of things.
Well, I've had the experience occasionally of running into bear in the woods. And actually, the only time I think I ever saw a mountain lion was in Hell's Canyon. And I was actually in my car on the road across the river on the Idaho side of the Snake River, and I see this mountain lion, and I think it was a young one, climbing up this cliff, and we had made eye contact and stared at each other for a while. But of course, for me, it was just this amazing transforming experience. I was in my car, so I wasn't going to get hurt, and I don't know how I would feel. I've talked to people who have encountered mountain lions in the woods, and I guess it can be a very frightening experience. But there seems to be this dichotomy between you see wildlife and you see the apex predators in the wild, that there's this awe of seeing them, and if you can see them at a far enough distance, then it's one of the most amazing experiences and translifting experiences you can have. But if you get too close, then it turns into something else. And you have a wonderful description in your book, I wonder if you share, about having such an experience with an apex predator.
Yeah, so and I would totally agree with you, Barbara. I mean, it's this strange combination, right, of fear and awe. I mean, just sort of us running into something beyond our ken. And we clearly have this deep relationship with other animals. And I think any listeners who have kids or grandkids or nieces or nephews have seen this, right? Children's natural enthusiasm and attraction toward animals. Which again is awesome, and then can also become awful when you're right there with a big predator. And yes, we did have a very close encounter with a grizzly bear about 5 minutes after landing in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You know, the bush planes fly over the Brooks Range, they drop us off, and bam, within 5 minutes, there's a grizzly bear. And it was an intense encounter for sure. I mean, here's this animal that could mortally, you know, wound any of us. Now there were eight of us, and we were able to scare it off. But I mean, it got close enough where our river guide did in fact break out the firearm just in case. It would have been horrible if it had come to that. But that was the intensity of the encounter. And again, it's just the kind of thing. And I've also had other, you know, grizzly bears encounters in Canada, and a number of black bears encounters in California and Washington and Alaska. But when you find yourself face to face with another predator like that, again, and I don't know how else to say it, it's just something that really I think, puts things in perspective and shows the limitations of our own power.
Well, another thing I found interesting in your book is you're describing all these remote landscapes that you go to, and you're mostly, all of them, you describe this great thrill and almost sometimes relief being there. But when you were in the Olympic National Rainforest, you described feeling kind of scared, and that there was something, I'm not sure if you said creepy or whatever, that the closeness of and the all the amazing amounts of vegetation that are many layers of vegetation there did something that seemed to unnerve you. And it reminded me of my experiences the first times I spent in the desert, where the desert used to unnerve me until I got to really appreciate it and kind of learn how to be in the desert. Because I grew up in a much wetter climate, and I guess you grew up in a much drier climate. So I wonder, when we go into the wilderness, I'm just kind of curious about your take on what kinds of wilderness areas unnerve you more than others, and why you were so unnerved being in the whole rainforest.
Sure, and I think you're probably right, Barbara. I mean, yeah, I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. Some of my first, wilderness experiences were in the Sonoran the Sonoran Desert. And so maybe kind of the sort of sense of unease I felt in the Olympic rainforest, maybe that's just my own solipsism, right? Maybe that's just coming from my own background. But as I mentioned in the book, we know now, from studies in cognitive psychology that, in fact, most people are more kind of unnerved in a close forest with a thick understory than they are in places that have got a more open vista. And the working assumption, but I think it's been pretty well established in the scientific literature, is because we evolved, right, in an open plain. We evolved in the African savanna, which is essentially an open landscape, one in which not only could our proto-human ancestors see the game coming and going, but could also see the lions and the cheetahs and the other, perhaps carnivores that would be searching for us. We could see them coming as well. And so, we seem a little bit evolutionary predisposed to the kind of park-like landscape of, say, the California savanna or the open plains or even the desert, right, which, again, offers the open vista. When you get to the forest, and especially a deep, dark forest like they have there in the Olympic Peninsula, and there's not much visibility, it becomes, more unsettling for people. And, of course, you think about, also I mentioned this in the book, people's often mixed responses to the word jungle, but a jungle seems a place that's kind of scary. Again, probably because there's not much visibility there. And so it's interesting how in some ways we're kind of hardwired for certain landscapes over others. And yeah, I do think, one of the things about going, again, to a place like the Ho Rainforest is not only do you feel that closeness, but you also feel, and again, this is why the wilderness is such an incredible teacher, you feel the sense of time, right, in an old-growth forest that, again, puts us in all of our aspirations and all of our technological pretensions, it puts it in perspective.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Jason Mark, who's author of Satellites in the High Country, and it's kind of a call for us to reconnect with wild places and do whatever we can to perpetuate them, because it's on our own survival interests. I want to talk now about some of the real challenges to preserving wilderness. I think let's go back to those kind of anachronistic experiences you had coming out of the Ho, for instance, which I guess I read another article a while back about how that's one of the few places in the lower 48 where you don't hear planes. At almost any other place in the planet, you're going to hear planes, but not the Ho. Is that true?
You hear some in the Ho, but there's much less. So there's a guy who's got this thing called the One Square Inch Project, and he's trying to find the quietest places left in the lower 48. And according to his survey, which he's been doing for years, there are only about 10 or 12 places left in the lower 48 where you can sit for 15 minutes and not hear a human created sound. And one of those places, and perhaps the most quiet place left in the lower 48, is in the Olympic rainforest. And that's why I went there, specifically to kind of experience that deep, almost geologic sense of quiet. And by geologic, I mean just kind of old, like an old sense of time, an ancient sense of time. And yet, once again, and this kind of gets into the, you know, the whole title of the book, Salads in the High Country, the mix of the way that technology kind of intrudes. After three or four days there in the rainforest, on our way out, yes, a twin-propeller Chinook helicopter flew right over the Ho River, and I later confirmed with a soldier at Joint Base Lewis-McChord there outside of Olympia that, in fact, the military often uses the rugged terrain of the Olympic Peninsula for training exercises. So just yet another example of how even when you get to a place where we are outnumbered by the critters, where, again, you can have that feeling of perspective, something is going to come in and intrude like a U.S. military helicopter. I think the challenge is to recognize that even though there may be no places at this point in the 20th century left that are truly pristine, that doesn't abolish wilderness and wildness. If anything, it makes it more important than ever.
Well, I was thinking, I had an interesting experience, one of my other first times backpacking back in 1971. I was in Sequoia National Park and up in 10,000 foot altitude in the wilderness area. And it was my first time being in this landscape, and actually maybe the second time I'd been in mountains. So that was very new to me. But the other thing that was very new to me was hearing these bombers flying overhead, because where I grew up, the bombers didn't fly. They seemed to like remote areas. So it seems that these technological, some of the harshest and most violent aspects of human technology also are gravitating to the same wild places that we gravitate to get away from technology.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. I don't know if any listeners have explored parts of the Nevada desert, but, you know, much of Nevada, of course, is public lands, and much of it is essentially used as a giant military training facility. So, yeah, I mean, I think the military is attracted to those places for, in some ways, the same reasons that recreationalists are. Again, it's a brutal training ground, and I don't want to overstate it, right? I mean, you know, you can go backpacking, and it does not need to be this kind of, you know, Teddy Roosevelt test of self, right? I mean, it can just be pure recreation. But for many people, I think, you know, kind of like the Outside Magazine reading set, people want to go into the wilderness precisely because it is a test. And I think that's why also the military gravitates there as well. It is a true training ground, whether, I guess, a military training ground or a physical, spiritual one. I just have to mention, because we talked earlier about, you know, the issues of race and ethnicity in the wilderness today. I think it's fantastic that probably the best avatar of that Teddy Roosevelt spirit in the 21st century, right, is not some dude bro who is into you know, the adrenaline junkie stuff. It's Cheryl Strayed, right? And probably that's the best example we have today of someone going into the wilderness to find themselves. And it's an incredible story, and I'm so glad that it's become this incredible phenomenon.
I was just actually thinking of Cheryl Strayed just before you mentioned her, because I was thinking of another really important part of being in the wilderness, which really comes through in your book, and it's my experience every time I'm out hiking, is that there's several tracks that happen at the same time. I mean, there's the physical track of just keeping your body going. There's the surrounding nature that you're absorbing and relating to and responding to. And then there's your internal mind, which is running through the whole thing. And I think that's one of the things I really appreciated about Cheryl Strayed's book, Wild, is that you get that internal monologue that's happening. And sometimes the internal monologue has nothing to do with the landscape that you're passing through. So how does that, why do you think that's so important that, or why do you think it happens that we get so tuned into our internal selves at the same time that we're in this very much externalized experience?
I mean, in some ways, I think it's the challenge of quieting the mind, right? And I think, you know, anybody who's gone on a deeper, say, foray backpacking into the wilderness, you know, something that's kind of a week plus, knows that you can spend the first 3 days kind of wondering, God, did I really turn off the stove at home? You know, and all of the chatter of our daily lives keeps up, and it really takes, you know, I would say a number of days, at least like day 4 or 5, until you can begin to shed some of that and the mind quiets. And I think that's another of the core values of the deep wilderness is that chance to just sort of let everything go and perhaps, you know, tune into a deeper kind of meditative state. At the same time, yeah, you're still going to have what somebody in the book referred to as brain radio. So I spent part of the book, I went to explore the deep Paleolithic scene of human rewilding. And these are folks who are, you know, living in the woods with only Paleolithic technology, you know, skins and bows and arrows and bow drills to make fires. And this young woman from England who had come over from England to spend, a good part of a summer training to then go on something called the Stone Age Living Project, said, wow, we were out there in the woods wearing only deer skins, and yet Britney Spears was pumping in my head. Again, what she called brain radio. And so, again, just another example of how hard it is to fully detach and disconnect and get back to some more primal state of being.
Well, besides the kind of brain chatter that you're talking about, I was actually thinking more about this place where your spirit gets really uplifted, and what's happening in the mind is not worrying about whether the stove is on or hearing Britney Spears songs in your head, but going into a much higher level. And actually, that I think that can happen if you take a good hike, even on a day hike, if you're in the right place and you're in the right frame of mind. But I wonder what you think might be in the wilderness that elevates our mind to go to a place where we start to feel connected to life and connected to our own lives and connected to much larger things as well.
I really have to imagine it is just I think some of the emerging studies in eco-psychology prove this out. There's a really great guy up at UW, at University of Washington, Peter Kahn, who's got a whole kind of lab there looking at eco-psychology and some of the new studies coming out of cognitive biology that have really shown the benefits, clear benefits to children, to people who are recovering in hospitals, to learning in general, of time in wild nature. I think hopefully listeners have sort of come across the term biophilia that was coined by E.O. Wilson, our sort of innate love of nature. And it's really important to remember that 95% of the human experience, of human time, was essentially spent in a Paleolithic setting, right? And even of that remaining 5%, 4% of that, most people would have been living in agricultural life, still living, you know, pretty much cheek and jowl with nature, even if it was a somewhat domesticated nature. So I think we're hardwired for it. And I'm really pleased to see the medical profession, the psychological profession really coming around and recognizing how important it is. So I think I think you're right. You can find it on a day hike as well, but I think it's really, you know, I went yesterday with my baby daughter to a place called Redwood Regional Park that's, you know, just a 15-minute drive from Oakland, California, and just spending 2 hours in the woods with her, I get quiet, she gets quiet, and I think it's just the response to being amid a whole different kind of stimuli.
Well, it's really great talking with you, Jason, and I thank you for your book, and I'll be curious to see what you do next.
Barbara, thank you for the invitation. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Okay, we've been talking with Jason Mark, who's author of Satellites in the High Country, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll be talking with Dr. Patrick O'Haron, who's the board president of the Portland Chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility, about how we prevent the Pacific Northwest from becoming a sacrifice zone for the fossil fuel industry. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Robbie Robertson. Thanks for listening.
and good morning. It is a minute before 11 a.m. Coming up at 11, it's Health Watch. Today, host Ellen Goldsmith speaks with Dr. Peter Levine, author of Trauma and Memory, Brain and Body in Search for a Living Past. And at 11:30, Roberta Hall hosts Health and Healthcare Forum. She speaks with John Hoffer and Hong Lee, ethicist at Salem Hospital, about ethical issues in the hospital. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. You're keeping the station going, keeping us on the air. If you're not a member or if you want to renew, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hats for the Homeless donation drive. From now through December 15th, Fire on the Mountain on 57th and Northeast Fremont, Los Gorditos at 12th and Southeast Division, Mike's Drive-In in Selwood, The Cup and Saucer on Northeast Killingsworth, and the Old Salt Supper House on Northeast 42nd Avenue will collect clean, new, or gently used hats, scarves, and gloves, and the folks at Zippity News will distribute them to local shelters. Dropbox locations and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from PBP Insurance, working to assist individuals.